Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 31st of August, as we record. We, or at least I, have braved air traffic control disasters earlier in the week to bring you today's show. And we come to you as usual from the FT recording studio. Today, we are looking at half-year figures from insurer Prudential and discussing its plan to propel itself forward in Asia. Then we move to Europe and look at what's dogging the German economy and if anything can be done about it. And we finish by going global with a preview of next week's cover feature, that being our annual Top 50 Funds. Joining me to discuss this are over the line Julian Hoffman.
Hello, Dan. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Julian. Mark Robinson.
How's it going, Dan?
Very well, thank you. And in the studio, Dave Baxter.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. We're going to kick off with Prudential then. Half-year figures out on Wednesday. A new chief exec, a new strategy now in tow, but we'll get to that in a minute. How did the figures themselves look, Julian?
Yes, I mean, they look pretty good on the surface of it because China lifting its COVID restriction meant that the insurance trade between Hong Kong and China picked up hugely. So the new business figures for that particularly was up by 500% over the course of the half. So it was from that point of view, it was a pretty solid set of figures. I mean, the really interesting thing about it was that there was a sense that the company didn't have a strategic plan, at least this time last year, but they actually came forward in these results, and the CEO put in quite a sort of chest-beating performance, I guess you could describe it, in saying how Prudential is going to double its new business profits within a few years. You know, that they're going to completely change how the insurer is managed, and you know, they're going to make the most of the Asian pivot, which really is what it's based on these days. So it was an interesting half for them, I guess. Although the numbers really, until you see what the comparison is going to be next year, were quite hard on their own to interpret. I guess that would be the best way of describing it. So in a sense, they had then had the space to put forward their new growth plan with all the sort of fanfare that it deserved. And so I thought that was an interesting part of it, but I mean Mark might have some thoughts on this, but I'm generally a Prudential skeptic, I think, but particularly of the way that they've pivoted to Asia, but on the surface of it so far it seems to be working, but you know, whether that will continue is an open situation, I think.
Yeah, the new growth plans, you say, targeting compound annual growth rate of 15 to 20% until 2027. Quite an ambitious or certainly an aggressive goal there. What do you make of some of the things underlining that you just spoke about in terms of, you know, the reorganization of the business, things like that? What kind of things are they looking to do there?
Well, I mean, obviously, they're looking at cutting costs inevitably, and there are a lot of costs that they can take out of it. I mean, there's a lot, you know, they send people around house to house on mopeds collecting premiums, for example, and I imagine that cost is going to get out of is going to be dropped as a more digital approach is adopted. And there's, you know, they're also looking at areas like India and Africa as a way of offsetting the Chinese market. I mean, that wasn't something they were talking about when they were pivoting to Asia. So they obviously recognize that some of the skepticism around the shares is related to how China is performing. So, you know, there is another market there to exploit. I mean, whether they're in the best position to do it is another question. But there is a combination. There is stuff that the CEO can do. I mean, he can keep costs under control because it is a cost-heavy business in some ways, and he has other markets he can look at. But again, you don't really know what the comparator will be until the China Hong Kong situation sorts itself out and you get comparable figures.
On that note, you did see, didn't you, as you say, the big increase certainly in Hong Kong business. China, you know, as we've come to expect with its slightly underwhelming, perhaps, reopening this year, was less impressive, albeit some of that Hong Kong figure, you know, a lot of that business, as far as I understand it, is mainland Chinese going to Hong Kong for these products. So, you know, that's reflected in the Hong Kong numbers as well.
Yes, I mean, you can't, it's difficult to separate them out, I think, one from the other. And obviously, it attracts the kind of well-off Chinese consumer that will be able to do that trade and buy those products in Hong Kong itself. So whether you should count them now as one market is a moot point. But yeah, I mean, China itself is not looking promising, really. And, you know, the numbers for them for that part of their business were relatively stagnant, I would have said, considering that... the whole market has been opened in recent times because of the lifting of COVID restrictions. So, yeah, you can see how the issues that that China has in its underlying economy are starting to affect the services that service that part of the economy. You know, the things that people can afford to buy on the back of their residential or, you know, their property wealth is starting to see a hit.
Yeah, I suppose there are two sides really to the coin, obviously, aren't there? On the one hand, you know, the long-term growth prospects, you know, an aging population, an underbanked and underinsured population are obvious, especially if you target the higher end. And I know they've been changing their business mix in China a little bit. On the other side, there's so much uncertainty in China and, you know, there could be some, you know, to take an extreme example, I suppose the threat of, you know, things like capital controls for people who do go to Hong Kong to buy these products could one day rebound, but that's you know, at the far end, I suppose, of hypotheses.
The country is exporting millionaires by the boatload at the moment, so you can't discount the idea that capital controls will not be brought in before the end of the year. But at the moment, we don't know. That's as simple as that.
Mark, what's your take on Prudential?
Well, I tend to think I'm probably slightly more optimistic than Julian, but that may just well betray a sentimental bias on my part, given that I used to be in the Pru in a former lifetime. I guess you could say that the group drew a line in the sand midway through 2020 when it offloaded its US arm Jackson to a private equity-backed insurer over there. And so from that point on, you know, as it's been well documented, it effectively became an emerging market play. And that's why current issues in China sort of imperiling what Julian described as its Asian premium, particularly as China's showing symptoms of what's been referred to as a balance sheet recession, you know, the sky high level of private debt is depressing economic activity there. And that's partly the reason why the bounce back hasn't been as pronounced in the economy as people had been hoping for. I did know in the results as well that there's an increased focus, I guess, on India and Africa. And I guess this assumes that, if this is in fact a gathering priority, it largely reflects demographic change, forecast demographic change. You know, you saw, and then there's reasons to back this up as well. India saw sales growth of 15%, was double that in Africa, and both locales have seen a marked increase in the number of agent numbers as well. So that goes some way to explaining why the group is actually well backed and why that valuation seems about right at the moment. They're looking, in fact, the forward rating is less attractive than it was this time last year, and the PEG ratio suggests that the market has it just about right at the moment. But you know, there's still a great deal of potential in terms of market penetration in Asia as well. And Dan, as you alluded to before, you know, the insurance market historically has risen in line with the expansion of the middle class, and that's going to play out further in China, one imagines, and perhaps to a good greater degree in some of those other emerging markets in Asia and, in fact, in Africa too. So I remain slightly more optimistic than Julian's piece suggested.
On the valuation you mentioned there, I suppose another question is really, you know, looking at who Prudential shares are for. You know, the dividend was increased, I think, maybe 9%, albeit when you factor in some currency fluctuations, there's not much of an increase there. But, and, you know, the overall yield is still quite low. It's not like the, you know, the kind of typical UK insurance business, yeah, which is perhaps why, you know, it's under pressure to deliver these ambitious growth targets to prove it can be a growth business.
Well, I think that's where it is in its space. I mean, you know, the insurance has been around for decades and decades. But given the pivot towards Asia, you could make the argument that it is entering or in the midst of a growth phase at the moment. That hasn't necessarily played out in previous years. But that, I think that's why it receives the backing it does, because obviously total returns for a stock like that pale next to some industry rivals. And I think that's just an acknowledgement of the fact that it is setting out, that it is pivoted towards these growth markets, and yet those the penetration levels are still relatively low at this stage.
What do we think of the question of, you know, domicile? As with HSBC, you know, it's a question that is raised with Prudential. Certainly now it has pivoted to Asia. Is that something that could come back on the table again in the near term, or is that, you know, in the long grass for now?
Well, I don't know, to be perfectly honest, but I'd be very surprised if it doesn't. There's a fair amount of speculation that this is exactly what will happen as more and more business is initiated in the Far East as well. And it's difficult to understand the rationale of a listing in London, aside from the fact probably capital markets in Hong Kong and elsewhere in Asia still aren't developed to the same degree as Western markets. But I mean, I guess so. You know, it's a sovereign investments, and pressure from Beijing itself will probably force Prue's hand one day.
Julian, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, they already have this strange hybrid regime where the accounting is partly regulated by the regulator in Hong Kong, which determines their capital ratios. But then they also do IFRS 17 for bits of the accounting. So it's a strange hybrid mishmash of regulation. So it might make sense for them just to concentrate everything in Hong Kong and just take it from there. But whether that, you know, given the company's prestige and it's waiting in the FTSE, whether that'll happen is another issue, or whether enough for shareholders would vote for it is open to question. But I mean, certainly the management, and actually not many analysts really are talking about the listing moving at all. So there doesn't seem to be this activism around Prudential that HSBC experiences with its shareholder base, for instance.
Yeah, I think I tend to side with you on that basis. Seems like, yeah, it might not be imminent. Never say never, I suppose. We've learned to be surprised, but yeah, that's, you know, something maybe for later on in future. Well, let's turn to you know, either something closer or further from home, depending on how you define Prudential nowadays, and that's Germany. Julian, you've written about you know, the country, the economy this week in the magazine.
Yeah, I mean, Germany is the land of my fathers, as it were. Yeah, it's a subject which, for obvious reasons, is close to my heart. But yeah, Germany is an interesting case both for investors and sort of economics watchers at the moment, because the country is going through its second period of stagnation in the last 20 years. So at the beginning of the millennium, it was dubbed the sick man of Europe. They, you know, they sorted out their welfare system and job creation, and China came on stream, and they were selling boatloads of stuff to China, and on the back of which was being, you know, production financed by and fueled by Russian gas. And now that those two macro stories have ended, the country has sort of slipped into a a kind of period of introspection and stagnation. And there's a real sense of doom and gloom around quite a bit of the DAX at the moment, which is kind of reflected in the fact that they have the same problem as the FTSE, and that several of the largest companies are kind of decamping to the US. Linde was the single biggest company on the DAX 40, as it is now. And that left last autumn to new pastures on the New York Stock Exchange. And that's also caused a lot of soul searching an introspection, which is also a uniquely German reaction to these kind of situations. But it is changing. The economy probably has to change, and the market probably has to change with it. I think that's the conclusion that we reach in the piece. It's a question of how effectively the government can stimulate, and whether they can reach any agreement on how to do that. That's the question, whether they cut personal taxes or they go for corporate taxes. Corporate taxes obviously would be better for share prices. But yes, it's a bit of a mess. I think that's the best way of describing it.
Well, on the subject of corporate tax, that does seem to be the initial move, doesn't it? Because there was this package agreed earlier this week in principle, €7 billion package of corporate tax relief in a bid to get things moving again. It hasn't really... there's a couple of points there, I suppose. One is that markets in general have been a bit more buoyant this week, so it's hard to discern any market impact from that specifically. The other side is that I think, as much as I'm sure corporations and companies appreciate that, there's been some dismay from the energy-intensive industry in Germany, of which there is, of course, a lot, that there's been no further support there. I suppose, winter is coming again. It's the final day of August now, isn't it? So, that could become a live situation again very soon.
Yeah, winter is coming. It's obviously a lot of their steel, they have very heavy industry that we don't have, or we haven't had here for a generation. So steel making, large scale chemical production, all that requires a lot of energy. And, they were getting cheap energy from Russia. And they've impressively, improved their LNG capacity and things like that. Mm. LNG is by its nature is a lot more expensive to import for Germany than, a pipeline going over the Urals, that does pose a question about how they're going to absorb that cost, and whether without some kind of support scheme, it'll just be unbearable for large companies to continue with those kind of heavy energy-intensive industries in the country. But nobody's talking about closing anything down yet. But it would be interesting to see by the first quarter of next year whether the people like ThyssenKrupp and BASF and those kind of household names, whether they're going to start moving production away from Germany in order to get take advantage of easier energy markets. But it's a long-term process. You could almost describe it really as that they're going through their late stage industrial decline, and in a way that Britain had to do in the 70s and 80s, which seems to have been delayed by at least a generation.
On the subject of investment as well, of course, existing investment is not necessarily going to be mothballed unless, things get really bad over the winter. But there have been some, I think, surveys in the past couple of weeks as well, suggesting that, new investment, as you point out, Julian, it is by German companies. They are increasingly looking abroad for that, given the pressures on that at home. So, that seems to be in train already.
Yes, that's right. The IFO came out with a survey recently, which is it's kind of the benchmark producer survey, and it's generally showing that there is a form of capital flight that's taken hold in the German market, and it's kind of reflected in companies listing elsewhere, isn't it? It's a form of capital flight, isn't it?
To conclude, perhaps on Germany, the other data point we've had this week is, pretty strong wage growth, which obviously is good on one level, but from the company's point of view, or certainly from the economy point of view, that has tied in with some fairly sticky inflation numbers, which does suggest maybe more hikes from the ECB on the way, which would be another headwind, of course. Mark, how do you see sort of the German situation in sum, if such a thing can be summed up?
Well, I guess why it's interesting as well, and if you take the view that Germany is the author of its own misfortune, it's relevant because many of the missteps that have been taken over there have actually been repeated in the UK too. So it's probably best that we don't become too smug about the whole thing as well. Some of the problems, such as the level of bureaucracy as well, that's obviously repeated in Whitehall. You could also criticize the UK's energy policy in much the same way as Germany's, because now we're only waking up to the fact that our previous infatuation with offshoring the tech for our nuclear industry, for instance, has put us in a vulnerable position. Germany has taken, the step to decommission all of their nuclear plants. I think the last one maybe went at the beginning of this year. That means that, like us, it's become more vulnerable to energy price fluctuations. And it'll be some time before both countries actually sort of make the nut on the energy front as well, because Germany has been quick to turn to renewables and is probably ahead of most other European countries in that regard. But as we've pointed out many times, that the intermittent nature of wind and solar means that it's actually had to increase its energy imports into the country as well, further exacerbating that vulnerability too. And we can't think that there must be much chance of that changing anytime soon. Over the long run as well, like the UK, the low birth rates mean that Germany faces a big demographic drag on growth. Possibly the UK's a little bit more fortunate in that regard, because our birth rate is slightly higher, and I think we have a larger percentage of inward immigration too, net immigration. So, I guess if you went by industry, Julian alluded to the heavy industry over there, but even some of the synonymous with German industrial power than its automotive industry, but even some of the automakers themselves have made some production decisions based on what are overly optimistic assumptions on the EV rollout. They're not alone in that, because the US manufacturers are going through that same process at the moment, but more problems and less solutions on the horizon. I mean, it's interesting in a way, because I mean, part of West Germany's success redevelopment in the post-war period was down to the compact between government corporations and the labor unions too. And that doesn't apply now. It appears, if anything, apart from the government measures taken this year recently to promote growth, the level of bureaucracy in Germany acts as a drag over the long run. So I think there's going to have to be some fundamental reform on that base as well.
On a positive note, to bring it back round to the investors' point of view, I suppose we should note that the DAX is up 14% this year, which is a pretty good return, all things considered. Admittedly, some of that might have been a bit of a relief rally given concerns about, deindustrialization in the winter. But we'll see if that can be maintained. A decent effort under the circumstances, though, certainly at the moment. It's time now, though, for our final segment of the show. This week's cover feature is on people power, human capital, and the role of a strong, well-incentivized workforce in making a good company and a good return. However, we are going to be talking about next week's cover feature, which, as I mentioned at the top, is our annual top 50 funds. Dave Baxter, our funds editor, once again in charge of assembling, compiling, crunching the numbers for this list, which we should say is a list of active funds. We have our separate ETFs list earlier in the summer. Why don't we start, Dave, just, I suppose, going through some of the first principles of the list. How are we defining the top 50? How do we try and compile it? How's it structured?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we already have our kind of list of passive funds and people increasingly are kind of interested in passive funds. So with this list, we're largely looking at those kind of active funds that are giving you something different, something you perhaps can't really get in a passive format, something distinctive. And of course, we're looking for cases where generally the fund managers and the teams, the investment teams, have managed to kind of generate some good returns, or I suppose in a few cases have managed to, you know, fulfill a stated purpose. For example, more kind of defensive performance or generating a good yield, and that kind of thing. But it is very hard, of course, to find, I suppose, the perfect active fund. And you have to accept that there is a kind of a level of cyclicality in their performance, and you have to be able to explain why it performs one way or another in a different environment.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of focus on active fund performance.
Yeah.
Tends to be in an up market, they'll say, well, we, you know, do more protection on the downside, and then you get a tougher market like this and you find, in some at least, that, you know, they're underperforming again. So, yeah, the caveats there are, A, it's about which funds you look at. B, it's about how you use them, how you combine them, as you just suggested, to, you know, produce a good return for your specific risk profile. So, yeah, that's what we try and do in this feature, I believe, you know, a mix of equity, bond, alternatives, focusing on some different styles as well. So something, hopefully, for everyone in there. The question, I suppose, for this year, looking ahead to next week's issue, you know, in theory, you could have a top 50 funds list that never changed any at all in any given year if you were, you know, really looking for the ultra long term. In reality, though, we obviously have to be mindful of things on the ground changing, you know, and certainly over the last 12 months, economically speaking, things have changed quite significantly, certainly in terms of the risk-free rate and things like that. So what's the level of turnover been this year? How's that compare to previous years?
So this year we've seen 12 changes to the list. That is kind of roughly in line, at least with last year. I believe last year we had 11, but there's been, I think perhaps the nature of the changes has been a little bit different this year. So last year we tried, as you mentioned, we tried to kind of introduce a bit more balance in terms of investment styles. So you do have, you know, different options depending on what you want. This year, you know, we've introduced changes across a few different areas, from kind of UK equities to a few of our kind of alternatives names. I think perhaps one theme with the changes is, if a fund hasn't particularly been doing what it's meant to, or perhaaps it's been a little bit kind of disappointing and not really seeming to perform as well as it used to, we've in some cases almost used that as a good excuse to introduce something fresher. So this year we've tried to introduce a few, perhaps some kind of newer funds, perhaps ones that people won't be as familiar with as the really big names, and ones that are kind of capitalizing on interesting trends. So to give one example, there's a fund in our Japan category that is, and this is a market narrative some people might be a bit tired of because they've heard it for many years, but there's the idea in Japan of there being corporate reforms, companies having to become more shareholder friendly. And we've stuck a fund in the list that kind of focuses on kind of activism with smaller companies and really, you know, kind of benefits from that trend.
Yeah, there's a balance to be struck, isn't there, between, you know, we should say this list is not just about performance. It's not based on who's done badly this year and therefore they're out of the list. Equally, when times are tough, as they have been in many markets in recent months, that does show you how well funds are actually delivering on what they say they are going to do. And that can lead to some changes. So it's striking a balance between, you know, recognizing when underperformance is to be expected and to be tolerated, and when perhaps it causes a rethink, or at least when the argument for a different fund becomes stronger. Where is there one particular area where more changes have been concentrated this year, or is it spread quite broadly across regions, asset classes?
It is spread relatively broadly, and I suppose there are more changes in the kind of equity part of the list, but that's partly a function of the fact that it is a pretty equity-focused list still. So 35 of the names out of the 50, I believe, are equity funds. I suppose we have, to give a couple of examples, though, we have seen a few changes when it comes to UK equities. So again, there we've moved away from a very well-established fund that, you know, people perhaps have some cause to believe that maybe it won't do as well as it used to simply because of its size and so on. And we've turned to a kind of newer, more interesting name that kind of has quite a distinctive approach and has really made a mark in the first kind of 5 years or so that it's been in existence. And yeah, on the same note, in the kind of UK income category, we've kind of restructured things a little bit. We've introduced a more core kind of income fund. Also, we've dropped a fund that is kind of actually a bit more total return focused, because I suppose that's just a market where if you really want yields, then you can go and kind of grab that with both hands. But yeah, we have seen changes elsewhere. We've seen a couple of changes in the bond space. We've seen a couple of changes when it comes to alternatives, things like kind of wealth preservation, so-called wealth preservation trusts. I guess one of the notes, there have been a couple of instances where we have picked up a fund basically because of what we've discussed in the past, this kind of bargain effect going on, I suppose, in the investment trust space. You know, you've seen those really massive kind of discounts ballooning out this year and I suppose last year as well. And now in some cases, that's just, you know, a really good reason to kind of jump on a particular trust while it's going at that kind of bargain price.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. Obviously, we are talking in slightly oblique terms here because yeah. This is a preview and the feature is out next week. So if you do want to find out what those funds are that we've just been speaking about, do pick up a copy of the magazine out on the 8th of September. But for today, that's all we have time for. So thank you very much to Dave, to Julian and to Mark. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next time with another Companies and Markets show.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.